Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Alan Levy on the Alan Levy Show on Blog Talk Radio. Welcome this evening. If you're listening to this show live, you're at blogtalkradio.com. I'd like to welcome you. And you could listen to this show as well on a podcast, and that podcast can be found on iTunes, on the Alan Levy Show, or you can go to blogtalkradio.com/Alan Levy. Once again, I'm so honored to be here tonight. I want to thank you for listening to this show, and it should be a very interesting show. My guest will be Alex Barnett, and Alex is a community program manager with Microsoft. He also has a blog, which we're going to talk about, which is alexbarnett.net blog. And, you know, we're going to get into some real interesting things, and I look forward to your phone calls tonight. So there's two ways you can communicate with the show. You can call with a question at 347-677-0649, or that's 347-677-0649, or you can Skype me a question. My Skype name is Blog Talk Radio. Feel free. Love to get your calls and chat up with Alex. So if I like to right now, I'd like to bring in Alex. How are you, Alex?
I'm good, thanks, Alan. How are you?
Great, thank you. And thank you for joining me.
No, my pleasure. Sounds like some interesting stuff that you're doing, so I was very happy to join you tonight.
Great, I appreciate it. So I see your blog, and we were just talking earlier. You're into some very interesting things, and I think that our audience, I mean, the people that are following my show on Blog Talk Radio, probably not as technically savvy as you or some of your readers. So maybe you could just give a brief description of the types of things that interest you and what you focus on with your blog, Alex Barnett.
The kind of things that interest me, I've been working pretty much on the Internet since the mid-90s when I kind of learned, self-taught myself how to kind of build a basic website and messed around with doing that, and then got into that professionally, and in the last kind of 11 or 12 years, have been pretty much immersed in the Internet and the web. So my interests and generally what I tend to write about is about the web. I guess more recently, I suppose, more on the kind of technical side of things, I tend to veer towards that. But I like to read a lot of content by some interesting people about the web, and specifically more about where it's going. I'm interested in the trends and the kind of things that are going to be big in the future, both for us as end users of the web, but also from a technical perspective, and kind of which are the technology trends that are going to transform the web and how we use it. We've seen a little bit of how I would say some of the early adopters, and it's still in a fairly adopter phase, is something like RSS, for example. So I've been writing quite a bit about that over the last few years. And more recently, something that has been termed as Web 2.0, which is always difficult to define.
Do you like that phrase?
Do I like it? I think it's somewhat helpful in encapsulating some ideas and concepts that are out there. I think it's unhelpful in some respects, in that with all things, especially in the technical world, that kind of it becomes a trend and a fad, and people start calling anything that moves and crawls a Web 2.0 thing because they want to just associate with some interesting stuff. So it's got good and bad to it. And one of the things that is always happening is kind of the definition of Web 2.0, what it means, does it mean anything, is it meaningless, or whatever. But I think it's fair to say that there are some interesting concepts in that. And we have seen over the last couple of years almost a renaissance, as somebody like Chris Perillo put it. I like that. A renaissance of the activity that's been happening on the web, both in terms of young startups doing some really interesting, innovative stuff, but also the way that we're using the web is changing, I think, quite dramatically in the last 5 years. And there are some trends that are happening which are very interesting. I think it's a great time for the web. It's different, I think, fundamentally to what we might have experienced in the industry in the dot-com era and the dot-com boom and bust. But there's some really interesting, substantial changes happening around the way that people use the web and some of the underlying technology behind it as well that enables these new and interesting things to be done.
Now, how would you define Web 2? How would you define, in general terms, Web 2.0 for my audience?
There is this aspect, which is the social network or the social media side of things. And what is meant by that is to do with how we are able to connect with folks that are using the web, and how there's this concept of, some people don't like the term, but it's user-generated content, stuff that we're producing, becoming really the new media rather than the large networks that used to, you know, buy content and distribute it maybe on the web, that there are new services that are facilitating interesting and new ways of being able to connect people together and for us to be able to share our content and find others that enjoy similar interests to ours, and then to be able to find that content and consume that content. So,
like Blog Talk Radio would be a good example of Web 2.0 kind of an application, user-generated content.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, that's, people ask me, are you, what, I, and I've written a post about it, in fact. So, you know, when I created it, I didn't necessarily think I'd be Web 2.0. I wanted to create a social medium, a network where anyone was empowered to create their own show and talk and engage or talk to an audience.
Right. I think that there is something else, though, around particularly kind of a network effect dimension that we're talking about. So a really good example is something like Flickr. Are you familiar with Flickr?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and that's a site which, you know, is aimed at people who want to be able to publish their photographs online and share them. Now, that's always been able to be done since the early days of the web, but what's kind of new and interesting is the way that a site like that has, been able to really connect communities with interesting ways of being able to categorize that content using tags, for example, and using those tags then to be able to share content amongst each other. So people end up actually gravitating around tags, particular tags that they might be interested in, and then subscribing to that tag through an RSS feed or going to a regular website that is all about that tag, for example. That's one example. Another is around the business model, where Flickr were one of the early players to provide their content through what's called APIs, which stands for Application Programming Interfaces. And what they did there is enable their content that was being stored on the Flickr servers that was being generated and created and uploaded by end users so that other third parties could then start creating new and additional services based on and around the Flickr content. So what they did is it's kind of counterintuitive maybe to the early businesses on the web, where what they wanted to do is kind of lock in the customer and say, hey, your content's ours, and nobody else is going to be able to get hold of it, and you're only going to be able to get hold of your content if you come to Flickr and log in and all the rest of it. Well, Flickr said, no, what we wanted to do is free that content up. And so if somebody else wants to develop a service that is using Flickr photographs, even you as an end user could then use this third-party service to do something other and interesting with it, or combine it with other kinds of content to create something new. So what that has done is using the power of the internet as a network to start being able to expose content and data to other services so new stuff can be created. And there's this kind of, there's a word called a mashup, for example.
Yeah, sure.
That a mashup might be photographs that come from a certain location. So you might get a map service, like something like Google Maps or Windows Live service maps, and then combine that with photographs that have been geocoded against a zip code or against a country, and now you can start navigating the same photographs but now using geographical space instead of maybe another interface. And that is an example where this content and these different services are beginning to network with each other, and new opportunities are emerging. And I think that's an example where it's kind of different to how the early web was, and that's the kind of 2.0 kind of moniker that's arrived. It's kind of, there's a renaissance and something new and interesting going on. From the consumer perspective, I think it's great news because it allows their content, essentially, with these new services to remain their own. I think it's an interesting debate as to whether customers actually care whether their content is portable or not. I'd argue that if they should care, so that you can get it out once you put it in, and that it can be used by other services if that's something that you choose to do. So there's different layers of this Web 2.0 thing that we're seeing, and I think it's fair to say that it's also been over-marketed. So there's, including myself, some kind of reticence to actually talk about Web 2.0 because it's been misused. But there's some interesting ideas actually fundamentally behind it.
Yeah, it's the speed at which things are going are just fascinating, and you're, of course, talking about things that are going to happen next year. It seems that there's a big gap. You know, they talk about in this country and in the UK and other wealthy countries, you know, the equality gap, the financial gap, the gap between people and society, those that have a lot and those that don't, from in terms of wealth. But it seems like that's happening, you know, with technology and the web. I mean, there's a whole, you know, group of people that, you know, are focused on the blogosphere and where it's going and some of these new platforms and new technologies, and there's just millions and millions of people that just don't get it, and it's like a sea change to get them there. But it's going to be interesting how that evolves.
You know, it's funny. I think it's probably a motivation for me is to go out and find out about the cool technical stuff is going on, because I do have a sense that it's kind of easy to be left behind. An example of that is something like Second Life, which you might have heard about. Are you familiar with Second
Life? Yeah, I've heard that. I think Curtis may have mentioned that to me.
Okay. So Second Life is basically a virtual world that is run on servers by a commercial company, and people go in and they log in and they do stuff in a virtual world. It's kind of like, imagine like a game that you might be running on a machine, where you interact with artificial intelligence and this, that, and the other, but instead of artificial intelligence, these are real people that you're meeting out online. And people build properties, and they're actually building shops, and there is a in one sense, it's a virtual economy. On the other hand, it's an actual economy. People are trading goods for real-world money, and you can buy stuff with real-world money in this virtual world. It's that kind of stuff that... I get the sense that, you know, if I'm not at least learning about it, and if at least I'm not tinkering about it, that it could be one of those things that really takes off, and a whole raft of people are in there, and there are others that aren't, and not because necessarily they can't afford it, although, you know, you do need money in order to be able to start doing stuff like owning land in that environment. So there is a kind of a divide in that sense, but there is a digital divide as well, which I know governments are very concerned about in terms of education, the use of computers, and the use of the internet. But there are these alpha, what we call the industry describes as these alpha geeks. These are the early adopters. These are people who are using technologies years, not months, but years and years and years ahead of the curve. Now, some of those just aren't going to materialize into anything substantial on a mass basis, but others become really big and significant phenomenons.
Like blogs have become.
Yeah, I think so. I think.
And RSS.
RSS to a certain degree, but blogs I think is a really good example. You know, I think the first blogs were really being written by folks like Dave Weiner in the late 90s, and he was out on his own pioneering this media. And probably some people thought he was a crazy loon doing this kind of weird weblog thing that nobody really got. But, you know, another small group of folks started to blog themselves, and before you know it, this kind of weird and crazy network effect, before you know it, not everybody's blogging, but a lot of people are. And the people that are blogging are, from a demographics point of view, probably those with higher incomes, better educated, and not because you have to be in order to blog, but it just happens to be in a technology sphere. It just usually is the way that the early adopters are in that demographic, and over time it becomes a wider and wider phenomenon. Anybody can pick up a blog and create one. All you need to go to either an internet cafe or whatever, but that's one of the keys. You need to be able to be in an internet cafe, and you need to be comfortable with, to a certain degree, the internet as a whole. And in my experience, if I look around my family or my friends or whatever, that there is definitely a divide. Putting the demographics aside, there is a divide there between the people who are really playing around with technologies and bleeding edge, and then those who traditionally regarded as laggards. But it's the pace at which this is changing is phenomenal. So.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's one other thing too, and when you talk about the individuals that are into blogging and maybe have a certain demographic, part of it has to do with the fact that while there are 55 million blogs, maybe 50 or 100 of those blogs actually make any appreciable revenue from their blog.
Well,
and 50
that's
million
one way
don't.
Of measuring it. That's one way of measuring it. I mean, I and there are definitely people who are blogging because they're motivated for financial reasons.
So, right. No. Let me just finish my point. So, Alex, what I was getting to is that those individuals that can afford to blog because they don't they've got other income or they're at a higher earning, you know, per capita income, they can do that. They can blog and afford to. Those that don't can't make money from blogging, so they have to. They're working. They may not have as much time to blog.
Yeah, but you don't have to try and make money while blogging, right? I mean,
no, of course not. And most don't.
And most don't. I mean, and most never will.
Right.
And that's cool. Yeah, that's fine. In the same way that most people who do art or do photography or write in a diary or do poetry or write in whatever, don't do it for financial and monetary reasons. There are other motivations and reasons to do it. And that's the reason that I think blogging has been successful, because it provides a kind of reward to people by A, being able to express themselves, and B, being able to actually create relationships through their blog that tie in with their interests. I think if it was a phenomenon that was associated with money, then it'd be very dull, actually. The reasons that blogging is fun is that there's lots of people that have never written for a living, are not writing for a living, and will never write for a living, who actually write brilliant stuff, very interesting content, and are very popular, and will remain content, never earning a penny.
Right.
From it.
Let's take a call.
Okay.
Hi, you're on Blog Talk Radio. Hello? Oh, this person hung up. No, I understand what you're saying. No, I fully agree, but this disconnect is material. It's do you think that's getting wider as things become more complicated, as you're thinking about other technologies and where things are going and the alpha geeks and where they're moving? Or do you see more of a convergence?
Well, the alpha geeks are the guys who are tinkering, and girls who are tinkering around with these technologies. I think then you've got the next phase, which is, you take these technologies and you play around, and then you move it into the more mainstream. You provide usable interfaces into these things so that they do become more and more mainstream. Most people really don't want to mess around with understanding the mechanics behind these things, but they are interested in the idea of being able to share photographs. And so these services, commercial companies normally will come along and turn that technology into propositions and into services that can be used by the mainstream. I think Flickr is a really good example of that. I think YouTube is a phenomenal example of that. And just in the last year, 2006, it's arguable to say that nobody had heard of YouTube in early 2006, and it's at least of a certain generation, every kid on the street knows it. And
so what do you think it was about it? Was it the what do you think was most compelling about YouTube and what how it just zoomed like it did in terms of growth?
One is ease of use, and two sides of the ease of use. One is the ease of use to be able to watch a video, just press a play button, and instantly it starts playing in your browser without having to mess around with any installation or download something or whatever. So the barriers dropped in terms of being able to instantly get instant gratification on a video that might be interesting to watch. The other side of the ease of use is the ability to easily upload that content once you've created it. So if you've got if you've recorded a video on your home cam or something, the process from creating an account to publishing it and then sharing it was dead easy as well, relatively speaking, compared to other services at the time. And so those two things, and then you've got a kind of a virtuous cycle going on. So the more content that there is, the more people that turn up, the more motivated you might be to upload the content. And it got this kind of viral effect. But also YouTube, what they did was make it very easy for your content to be shared. So you might have a blog and you'd be able to embed a YouTube video inside of a web page and show the video without having to point the user through to another site. And of course, in the video itself, it's branded YouTube, and that was great marketing because people got to hear about YouTube that never played with it before, and there they were just watching a YouTube kind of branded or facilitated service. But fundamentally, I think it's ease of use. They video sharing and the ability to be able to watch videos has been around a long, long time on the web, and YouTube just made it simple.
The fact that these players were made and able to be emailed and again, I think MySpace is probably more responsible for YouTube's success than anyone. In the sense that so many the MySpace members in the community use YouTube throughout their site.
Yeah, that's right. And
I mean, they really helped build it.
It's amazing how quickly it crept up on us. It's like I said, at the beginning of the year, nobody really heard about it. By the end of the year, 2006, it's everywhere.
But you'd be surprised. I mean, we see it a little. We're starting with Blog Talk Radio. We have these embedded players that we put on people's MySpace pages, or we put on their blogs, let's say. And people come and listen to the shows, their archive shows on their sites. And now we're building we have a flash player we'll be distributing, and people can email shows and, hey, listen to this show, and this I was on that show, and so on. When you start circulating these players, it really creates a great viral stampede almost. I mean, that was huge for YouTube.
Agreed. I mean, that's how I came across YouTube for the first time, is seeing it embedded in a blog post. And,
right.
And I saw enough of those to suddenly, you know, to get familiar with the brand. And then before you knew it, I was actually going to YouTube to go and find interesting content rather than wait for somebody to post it.
Exactly. And you don't have to go to their site to find what you want. I mean, in other words, people are, they've, that brand is just everywhere. And so, you know, it's quite ingenious. And, of course, they've done quite well. And I guess also in your position, which maybe we just briefly describe what you do. I mean, obviously you need to be out there looking at things. You do work with Microsoft.
Yeah, I work in a part of Microsoft that builds technology for developers. So as you can imagine, Microsoft has all sorts of customers, from people working at home on a computer to people working in a business using computers in the office, through to people who maintain large computer systems, through to developers. And developers are the guys and the girls who build the applications that get used on the computer. So I work for a product group, happens to be part of SQL Server, which is a Microsoft database product. Inside of that team, there's a team called Data Programmability, and that team is responsible for all the technologies that developers use when they're using Microsoft technologies to be able to access databases and write programs that are data aware. So data is everything in the world that I'm coming from, and my role is to work with the community so that they can get more out of Microsoft technologies, our existing technologies, and also work with our product team and our customers to help around the planning about what future technologies our developers need and what improvements we should have on our stack. So it's a million miles away from the kind of consumer world, the products that I'm involved with. But it's relevant, you know. At the end of the day, the ability to be able to share this content, the ability to be able to share data, in particular structured data, across the web, is massively important. It's what makes and is making the internet an interesting place to be. So I guess in some respects, what I write about on my blog on it from a day-to-day perspective isn't necessarily tied into my day-to-day work, but sometimes it is. So I generally blog about more of the geeky stuff.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we all hear about what's going on with Google and you know, how significant they've become. And in the last 5 years, where Microsoft's position is how is Microsoft's position be vis-a-vis the developers, the developer community, 5 years ago to where it was a year ago to where it is now? Because I sense that things are starting to be more transparent with Microsoft and moving in the right direction. And what do you say about that?
Well, I think I would agree with you in that Microsoft has become a more transparent entity for its customers, both for end users, what we might, you know, consumers, but also in the technical space, in the developer space. So you might have heard of Robert Scoble.
Sure.
For example,
he's going to be on my show in January.
Excellent. He really wasn't the first at Microsoft. There were others who were the first bloggers as employees at Microsoft. People like Joshua Allen, for example, and a few others who really started really pioneered that side of things. They were talking about their roles. They were also talking about personal stuff, but they were talking about the technologies of Microsoft. And then Scoble came along. He was employed in a team which is called the Developer Evangelist team, run by Jeff Sandquist. And Robert was really taken on to help Microsoft become a more transparent organization, with regards to where we were going and what our technologies were about, but also something critical he did was really push and drive the idea behind the notion that it's about having a conversation with our customers, that this isn't a one-way street. Traditional marketing has been very much coming from a place where you develop a position around your brand and your products, and you buy media and PR time, and you go out and you just keep thumping home a advertising and marketing message through to customers to the point where they end up believing you. And that's what you might describe as traditional marketing. Something called the Clue Train Manifesto was one of the first documents out there really kind of pushing a different idea, which is, well, you know, in order for your products to be the best they can be, and in order for the products to be loved by your customers really have to be involved in the process of making that product what it is. And the only real way to do that is to listen to your customers, and not just to listen to them in a kind of traditional market research perspective where you might buy in research, commission research, but really in terms of having conversations with your end users and listen to what they've got to say, listen to their criticisms about their products, and also help them in the other way is also help them understand why you're making decisions that you are, and be open to course correction and making changes about your product based on your customer feedback. And Scoble, what he did was really push that idea out to the extreme. And he happened to be at Microsoft when he was doing it, and with that he brought on and encouraged a lot more bloggers at Microsoft to do the same. And we've got something like 4,000 plus bloggers at Microsoft now, really on a day-to-day basis, having conversations with our customers. And that means blogging about what they're doing, but also through the comments and through reading customers' blogs in talking about those products and how they could be better. And that really, before I joined Microsoft 5 years ago, Microsoft with this kind of dark monolithic thing out there that I use their products every day, but I really didn't know any of the faces. Obviously, there was Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer and a few of the others, but I didn't get a sense that I knew the company nor anybody actually at the company, and could never feel that I could actually talk about any particular product or a gripe or an improvement that I might want with somebody who's responsible for developing that product, and not a marketing person or a PR person, but the actual product team that are involved. And I think that in the last 5 years, because of Scoble and other bloggers at Microsoft, have changed the way that we are perceived in that regard, and we are having those genuine discussions and conversations. I would recommend anybody that's interested in this topic to get Scoble's book, Naked Conversations.
I read the book, and that was actually the first book I read before I created Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, and this was, and Shel Israel, in fact, before I launched the site, I sent him an email and asked him what he thought about this idea, you know, that I had for Blog Talk Radio. And he was very nice, and he responded. And I think his words were, "You're going to hit it out of the park." Those were his words. And I saw Scoble. I never met him, and I saw him at a podcast conference in Ontario, California.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, he's like a rock star. I asked him, "How does it feel being a rock star?" He goes, pretty good."
That's right. And
so he's going to come on here. I know he's with PodTech now.
PodTech, that's right. He joined a startup. He's now the VP of content development or something like that.
Yeah.
Moved back to San Francisco.
What's your sense of the podcast space?
It's video cast as well, or screen, you know.
Right.
He's almost doing what he did at Microsoft with the Channel 9 brand, which was this really interesting work that he did where you go in and visit you literally knock on the door of a product team. They knew he was coming, but it was all completely unrehearsed. And he'd go in there with his handy cam and just ask questions about what that team was doing and stuff. And And it was really successful, and Channel 9 continues to be very successful. We've got more people doing that inside of Microsoft. But, you know, looks like Scoble wanted to go and do that same idea out to the tech industry as a whole, outside of Microsoft, you know, to go and visit people like Google and eBay and, you know, whoever else he's speaking to these days. I think it's a great idea, and he gets to interview some very interesting people. Must be having a blast.
Yeah, well, I was emailing him, and we reached out, and he agreed to be on my show in January, which is good, too, because, you know, we don't consider ourselves podcasters, but this show will be archived, and you can it's got RSS and so on, and you could subscribe to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was emailing him, and he says, I happen to be on a plane going to the UK. I said, oh, great. I said, you know, because I lived in the UK in the 90s for a couple of years.
You
lived in North London in Hampstead.
Oh, in Hampstead, yeah.
Yeah. Well, where are you from?
I was pretty much in Hampstead for about 15 years, Belsize Park.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So I lived in Hampstead right near the park, and I would take the Northern Line, and my office was in Knightsbridge, actually. I was in telecom back then. So I said, well, if you like Thai food, you have to go to Churchill Arms.
Okay.
Which is right off on Kensington Lane, I think, off near Hyde Park.
Okay.
So he was on the plane. I guess he had some sort of Wi-Fi connection, and he was emailing me back and forth and thanked me for the referral.
Oh, that's good. So I haven't heard of that restaurant. It sounds like...
Well, it's a pub. It's a pub, but it's in the back of the pub is a Thai restaurant, and the food is just great. And, you know, so I happen to love London, and so you lived in Belsize Park. I mean, that's very close to Hampstead, of course.
Yeah, it's just down the road, right?
Is that where you grew up? I mean, you grew up there?
Yeah, my first 7 years were in Spain. My mother's Spanish, my father's English, and I was born in Spain and raised there. And then we moved, when I was seven, to Belsize Park, where I lived through to the age of about 17. And then from then really started my first career, which was professional cricket.
Oh, really?
It was nothing to do with what I do now. And as part of that, I got to travel around and live in some interesting places and outside of London, Manchester, not very glamorous, but it was an interesting experience, but also Australia, South Africa, New Zealand. So I did that for about 8 years, coming back to London on and off. And then I came back to London in 1995, 96, where I joined a web design company. And then was there for 7 years. We grew that company, and then we sold it. And I've been in London during that time. And then I started working in Reading for Microsoft UK, and that was about 5 years ago. So
I see.
Now I'm living in Redmond, outside of Seattle. So I moved to Microsoft HQ a couple of years ago.
Do you see the how's the technology place, you know, in Europe, in the UK? I mean, in terms of, are we ahead of them, behind them?
Yeah, I mean, when I say we, I think...
the US, I'm saying, I guess, what we're doing here in terms of...
Yeah, America, in particular the West Coast, has just been, it's always ahead of the curve. It's got Silicon Valley there, it's got the venture capital, and it's self-perpetuating thing, and that it attracts smart people in the technical industry who want to get startups going and attracts money. So there's a real environment, particularly on the West Coast, but also on the East Coast as well, places like Boston, where that kind of innovation is really encouraged, and the environment is right for that. I think London and the UK as a whole is second place in terms of just the amount of online innovation that goes on, but it's a good second place, I'd say. There's a lot of interesting stuff that gets done there, a lot of creative minds, good technical minds over there. There are some interesting services that have the potential to really go global, although we haven't really seen that, to be fair, even in the dot-com stuff.
Well, Skype.
Skype, did you say?
Skype.
Skype, I think, is originally from...
right, not from the UK, but, I mean, Skype is the one global platform that is, you know, has succeeded, and it looks like Well, now they've just changed the pricing formula. They're actually going to be charging in the United States.
Yeah, and they're also now owned by an American company.
Yes.
eBay.
Yeah, sure. Right.
But, yeah, I think Skype's a great example of some of the stuff in innovation. I think there's another company called Last.fm that does great stuff.
What's that?
Last.fm is a it's a music site that allows you to be able to share the interests, if you like, of your music that you listen to. So if you what you do is you download a little plugin, it monitors the stuff that you're listening to, it plays that back onto the website, and then that is shared information with others, and there's some kind of collaborative filtering that goes on in the background, and based on what you're listening to, it'll come back and say, hey, well, you know, if you like this, you'll like that, because other people are listening to this
right
as well. So
how did they get around the copyright infringement issues?
Yeah, they don't. I don't believe that they're not having to play the music in order to do this. They're just making the recommendations. So you'll like this track by this band, and then they can point to it. I think that they do some low quality streaming, so you can sample it, and that's. I don't think that's an infringement. With the relationships they got with the record companies or however that works out.
Low quality sampling. So in other words, you can play a 30-second, a minute piece of something, and you don't. That's not an infringement.
Yeah, or it might be the whole track. I'm not too sure how that works, but it's enough to be able to. I mean, the way that I use it is that it'll recommend specific tracks that I can go and just check out for a few. Maybe for a whole track, but low quality. And then if I like it, I might go and buy it or investigate a bit further. So that's an example of kind of this recommendation system where the content, ultimately the value is being generated by the users because they're the ones that listen to the music and allowing that behavior to be kind of recorded and then shared with other users. But of course, in return, that they get some great recommendations. So it's a good relationship between the end user and the company. And then they allow the end users then to if you've got a blog, then you can kind of get this little bit of JavaScript and stick it on your blog, and share with people the music that you're listening to at the time, and kind of other interesting stuff. So that's a UK company that's doing. That's doing really well. There's a company called Blinks TV, that is more of a search around TV content, video content. There is a RSS-based advertising company in Ireland that I'm trying to remember the name now. It's something begins with N. I can't. It'll come to me. Nook, I think it's called Nook. Okay, it's more kind of focused around the advertising industry, but so there are pockets of this innovation. I think a lot more could be done, but it's a lot of people that are interested actually move out of Europe and come over to the West Coast as well. So unfortunately, you get a bit of a brain drain going on.
Fascinating. Someone IM'd me a question. Actually, my partner IM'd me a question. He knows that you're on tonight, and you may not know the answer to this question, so please let me know if you do or not. But if we wanted to reach someone at Media Player to in terms of their podcast, how would we go about doing that in terms of registering with them? I mean, we're speaking with, let's say, iTunes and others. I mean, is there some group that's responsible for this that we can actually reach out to?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the first part of that question?
We want to be a listed Blog Talk Radio as a directory, Windows Media Player, to be an option. And we have, we're doing hundreds of thousands of downloads a week now.
Right.
So we'd love to, be able to drive that traffic to Windows Media Player, and we've been unable to reach someone there to see if we can become or what it would take to become, registered there.
Yeah, well, I think... I don't know the answer to that right off the bat, but we can follow up.
Okay, great.
Offline. Yeah.
That would love to do that. Love to do that. Yeah. You know, I think, you know, look, I think it's fascinating what's happening, and you know, it seems you're right in the thick of it, so it's quite exciting. Are you planning on doing any more podcasts? I saw that you did one with Gilmore and your partner with Joshua Porter. You were doing a podcast?
Yeah, so Joshua Porter and I just, we found that we were blogging about similar things. We had a similar interest in some areas. And so what we did together was just started inviting people to go and speak to about some of the stuff that we found interesting. Completely low budget. And to our amazement, some of the people that we were really thoroughly enjoyed their blogs or their writing or work that they'd done previously accepted the invitations that we sent out to get podcasting. And I learned a lot, actually, by having those. We had Mark Cantor, who's the founder of Macromedia. He's an interesting individual, great ideas man, never shy of saying what he thinks, but he's got some strong positions around, you know, the whole notion around how we share data and the interoperability between these services online. And Gilmore, you mentioned, Steve was kind of a thought leader around this attention space, and we wanted to discuss with him some of the things he'd been writing about. There's people like Kim Cameron, who's the chief identity architect, I think is his official title, at Microsoft, and a guy called Dick Hart, who is at Skip. So, and others, Nick Bradbury, who developed the FeedDemon software, which is an RSS reader I've been using for years. And we just got talking geek stuff with these people, and it was great. They all said that they'd be happy to come along, so we did that. I was enjoying it. Unfortunately, I think probably time and other priorities and just kind of faded away. Might come back and do that at some point. I really did enjoy doing it. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I learned a lot and spoke to some really interesting people. So we did, I think, about 10 in all.
Well, maybe we could convince you to give Blog Talk Radio a shot and maybe do some panel discussions.
Yeah, well, I like the phone-in thing.
Yeah, you know, where people can call in and participate. And,
yeah.
You know, and so, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, always happy to give it a go. I think if it makes it easy, it's like coming back to what we were saying earlier, right? If it makes it easy for somebody like me just to be able to record the content and upload it, and then you've got some added value stuff like the phone-ins, this, that, and the other. Then
well, there's no recording. That's the thing with us, too. We don't – no one. You don't have to record anything.
Well, yeah, you exactly. I mean, like, we're having this conversation, but it's getting recorded, and then it'll be up in line later, right?
Yeah, it'll be up in line on my host channel in 20 minutes, and then it's subscribed. So
yeah.
There's no worry about recording and record, you know, any of that.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's – we're doing something else that I think is going to open up the world, and maybe I'd like to talk to these people in the UK, which is that we're going to tie VoIP to the back end of the platform.
Okay.
So no one will have to use a phone any longer. It'll essentially be click the call, and click the call, the host can click the call in, and the listener can click the call. So, you know, we already have adoption. We have people using it from many, many countries. But when this happens, you have people in France, Italy, Spain, everywhere will be able to, you know, essentially to have talk radio without the need of using a phone or incurring any charge.
That's great. I mean, one of the technical problems that I know, not just me, but others have been trying to figure out on their own, and, you know, some efforts to try and solve it, has been how you do that, right? How you make it easy for, you know, let's say that it's a Skype call or VoIP or whatever, just to be able to have that kind of connection there and to easily make it live at the time. This is one thing, which is to stream it out, which really is a significant technical problem to try and solve. And if you're able to solve that, that's great. But then to have that recorded and downloaded. I mean, there's lots of different things. I can't remember how many things I tried to solve that. And in the end, I had to just gravitate to recording a phone call and then saving it as a WAV file and uploading it, and it's a painful, laborious process.
Yeah, and that's what we've done in constructing this. We've taken all that out, where you simply just use a phone. We have a little switchboard I'm looking at, and people call into the switchboard. You have up to five people calling, and then those are streamed and then recorded. And I think that if you take the complexity, I think that's the problem with podcasting in general, that it's complicated, it's expensive for many people, and the other thing about it, which we're doing this live, we're having a conversation, I think it's compelling, I think it's interesting. Podcasting I find to be canned in many ways, and people, unlike blogs, which are viral and free and open, and you can make a mistake, you can make a typo, people view the podcasting, their podcast, very, in a different way. They have to be very crisp and clear and pure and highest of quality and edit out the little ums and the likes and...
Right.
To me, it's inconsistent. There's a contradiction there.
Yeah, they try to get a little over glossy, right?
That's what I mean, and I think that's going to ultimately be a problem for the industry.
Yeah, I think. It's again, it comes down to the motivation for why people are doing this and their particular style. I like my personal thing is I like rough and ready. Just have a chat. You know, the ums and the ahs are all part of it.
Yes, right.
Conversation. And, you know, and I think that that's one of the reasons I think YouTube has been interesting is that it's just rough. Screencast is another medium where people are recording their screen. I think in the early days it used to be all very polished and expensive production costs about how to do this. Now anybody can do that, and it's almost free, depending on what software you're using, but you just whack it up there, and the value is just as great for the person watching or listening or hearing this stuff. So yeah, I'm all for the rough and ready stuff. But you've got an English lady.
Yeah, we
recording.
we did a recording of an English lady doing Blog Talk Radio. I don't know why I had this desire that when we created the company, I said I have to have a British lady doing the opening intro. So I had around 12 or 13 different versions of this, and I selected this one. Something was just gnawing at me. Because I know that this is going to be a global platform because everyone around the world loves to talk, and everyone loves to listen. And I just had to have a British lady doing the – people, many have asked me, why is she – is this a British company? I said, no. I just had to have a British. I just, you know, I flew Virgin so many times. I guess it's the women in the white in those red dresses, and they were so nice. Would you like a massage? You know, and love that.
Okay. So, is it, the voice does sound familiar, though. Does she do a lot of voiceover stuff?
I have no idea. I paid about $250 for it.
That's good. Can you press it now? Is there a button you can press so we can hear what? So the folks at home know what we're talking about.
That's actually I don't know. I'd have to give that. I'd have to see. I wouldn't want to risk terminating the call just for that.
Okay.
We'd have to.
Right.
You know what? If you care to, you know, begin your own show at some point down the future, you could listen to her all you'd like.
Yeah. Well, I might. Okay. Thanks.
Or of course, if you actually. You don't have to do your own show. Any show you listen to on Black Book Radio, any archive show, you'll hear her as well. So,
okay.
She's quite charming, that voice. It's very appealing.
Well, it made me feel at home.
Well, very good. Well, Alex, it was very nice speaking with you tonight, and I appreciated the conversation. I enjoyed it.
No, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And your website is, again, your blog is alexbarnett.net?
Yeah, so alexbarnett, this double T, .net.
Okay. And your email, I don't think I have your email address, but I'd love to exchange contact information with you. Mine is alanlevy@blogtalkradio.com. So
okay.
It's quite easy, and perhaps we can maintain a dialogue.
Sounds good. I look forward to it, Alan. Many thanks for inviting me. I've enjoyed it very much.
Very good. Thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you.
A good night.
Good night.
That was Alex Barnett. Real nice guy. Joined me this evening, he is really out in front of the curve, I must say, identifying what's going on and what's happening. It's fascinating stuff, and I really appreciate it. And he's from Belsize Park, which is very close to Hampstead, which is some great times that I had. So with that, I'd like to thank you for listening to the show, and I'll see you next time on air. Have a good night.